From RTE Radio, I'm Niall O'Sheridan. This is Playback Daily.
And they sat in the little theatre of the Viking upstairs in the sheds. And
just the two of them.
And I don't think I've ever been more terrified, because I haven't played that many people that are in the audience that I'm playing. Do you know what I mean?
So how much time would you be given generally to come up with a piece of music?
Like, sometimes we'd have to turn a track around it within 24 hours.
What?
Yeah.
We had 11 single males, 11 single females, and they had the choice of the two saunas.
Coming up on this post-Patrick's edition of Playback Daily, the pressure of playing a real-life character when they're in the audience. The pressure of coming up with music for trailers, video games and TV shows, sometimes at very short notice. And the pressure of singles night when you're in a sauna. That's all on the way over the next hour of the radio catch-up show that's been working in an Irish sweathouse for years. And first up today, as part of his morning monologue, Oliver Callan talked about the many St. Patrick's Day parades on show on the 6-1 Evening News on Monday.
Did you brave the cold yesterday for the parades? It looked freezing in parts of the country, despite the lovely warm sunshine we had in the run-up to it. Amazing coverage as ever on 6-1 last night. I sit down with a cup of tea and absolutely drink it in. I love the boldness and mischief, mayhem and homemade health and safety adjacent parades that take place outside of Dublin in particular. Loads of people dressed up as Trump. I think this is the most Trump ever we've seen in regional parades of a St. Patrick's Day. Of course, over the top recreations of Zelensky meetings, including one there. I love the footage went unedited into the RT News where it came off a trailer and they just continued kind of scrapping on the street. And there was even a Michal lookalike as well. A very convincing one as well. I can't remember what part of the country it was, because there's about 40 parades covered in about half an hour on the news. And loads of dramatisations of Storm Éowyn blackouts and the repairs as well on the back of flatbed lorries. I didn't see that one coming, but it just shows the kind of sense of humour we can derive out of almost anything. And also the random grand marshals of country parades. In one town there was a couple who just happened to be married 65 years, and someone said, "You'd make grand marshals for the parade, off you go." And it is just absolutely perfect. They're kind of outdoing the Dublin Parade now, because obviously with all the rules of sustainability and environmental stuff, it's a very lo-fi parade. Everything has to be pushed or cycled along, so you end up with very kind of lightweight things, because obviously if they're not driven, they need to bring back a few engines, I think, into that parade. I think the only engine was the Onuach Thron, being brought up in his lovely blue Audi for his final St. Patrick's Day as our first citizen on the streets of Dublin. But you miss the vintage cars and things that you'd see every other day of the week. It's down O'Connell Street. I was worried for them a little bit when I saw the customs officials marching with sniffer dogs on the street and going, "Oh my God, this is the city centre. The dogs will never know. They'll just assume the whole world smells like this all the time." So that was a worry, but it passed off without incident, and it was great crack. 500,000 people, isn't that what they say, lined the streets for the Dublin parade? So it does the job. And the freezing one in New York, I was spectator and on the street. It was 2006, nearly 20 years ago, and they don't have any floats or anything like that in the St. Patrick's Day parade in New York. But it happened. And I heard in the news say that Sydney had the biggest one ever, which is no surprise considering that's where all the young people are nowadays, isn't it? Thanks to the housing crisis.
At least that parade might have been a little warmer than the one in Dublin. Yeah. Meanwhile, speaking of Australia, Belfast rap Gaelgeor trio Kneecap are currently touring there and gleefully annoying the Tory press in the UK.
The bowels lads that are Kneecap have been making the headlines in the Tory newspapers. The Daily Telegraph this morning tells us that a severed bronze head of Britain's King George V, which was removed from its statue in Melbourne last year in a protest, turned up at a concert by Kneecap, an Irish Republican band, they call the artists, in Melbourne. And video footage show the head of the king, who reigned from 1910 to 1936, on stage during the performance. And there was nothing to do with Kneecap themselves. The head was sawn off a statue in Melbourne in June of last year, and it's part of protests for Aboriginal rights. And they've been targeting Captain Cook and Queen Victoria statues as well down in Australia. So The band wrote on Instagram, the concert was on Friday, said some madman dropped in with a huge King George's head so we could hear a few tunes from our last Melbourne show. And the head was cut off last year. It showed up in various places, including on a barbecue. It's a huge thing, by the way. I don't know how this got into the concert. And obviously they're very upset about it in the Telegraph. You know, it's a 50-second video. The attack was posted by a group that calls itself the WACA, or Whistleblowers Activists and Communities Alliance. So it was Australia Day. The statue was burned on a barbecue. It was also had been dumped in a loo, and it's been decorated with a feather boa on other occasions. Police are still investigating the desecration of the statue and are constantly looking for the whereabouts of the head. No one's been arrested, and the Melbourne Crime Investigation Unit of police detectives are still searching for this head. It's a bizarre story. And the kneecap lad. There was footage of another concert they did. This was indoors, I believe, that one. And last month, a week ago, kneecap performing in Melbourne to 14,000 people. Again, all the Irish people who've run from the housing disaster here in Melbourne. Just an incredible backdrop to all the skyscrapers in Melbourne and the size of the crowd. And they are just huge. Loads of Palestine flags at that as well, along with the Aboriginal rights, as you'd imagine. Now, on the flip side of that, of course, we'd never condone desecration of statues of the British Royals representing our friends across the water. There's a huge photograph of the British Royal Kate, Princess Kate, she's the Princess of Wales, drinking a half pint of Guinness to mark St. Patrick's Day. Notably for our purposes, because we were speaking to O'Neill's Flowers here in Cooley Mountains at the weekend, or last week, about how they're only selling produced a third of the shamrock they grew last year, shamrock farmers, along with the flowers they do throughout the year. She's wearing a big clump of fresh shamrock, so it happens across the water as well. And she was celebrating the Royal Irish Guards. They mark St. Patrick's Day every year, and the regiment was created in the year 1900, and they have Irish Wolfhounds as their what would you call them? You know, the things that represent mascots. That's the words I'm looking for. And so they had two new ones, Seamus, and I can't remember the other one's name, but she was wearing all green and representing St. Patrick's Day in the Royal Irish Guards. So they mark it there too. Most of it's on Sunday, though, for the official St. Patrick's ceremonies for the Irish citizens and offspring of them over the years.
The kneecap lads would probably be very impressed by Oliver's segue there from their Australian shows to a bona fide member of the British royal family. Well played, sir. And as long as he's talking about royalty, that will inevitably bring him to the White POTUS.
Well, Donald Trump had a very busy weekend. I'm trying to sum up all the things so that you need to know exactly what he's up to. Since Friday, what has he been on? He revoked 19 executive actions signed by President Joe Biden that promoted clean energy and environmental goals. That'll be celebrated by Republicans. He also said Biden's pardons that he issued just before he stepped down as president were void because they were signed by AutoPen. That's the printed signature that annoys people who go paying for autographs and so on. The printed signature rather than done by hand. But the BBC reports, they say there's no evidence that Biden's pardons were signed by AutoPen, and there's also no law which renders an AutoPen signed executive order. His executive orders and his pardons are not null and void if they're just signed by AutoPen, is what they claim. Trump says he's going to put it to the courts to find out if that's true. And while he was at it, he's battling with the courts, because he invoked a 1798 law. That's a year that means a lot to us. But over there, it was a wartime law to deport people during a time of war, which they say is now in America, the Trump administration. So they deported people over the age of 14 who allegedly have ties to Venezuelan and Salvadoran prison gangs. They put them on planes to El Salvador, and a federal judge who showed up wearing a blue jumper apologising because it was 3 o'clock in the morning and he didn't have time to put on his black robes. And he ordered the administration to stop using wartime power to carry out any deportations. He ordered any planes already in the air to be turned around. It's unclear what was going on. Some of the planes they believe had already landed, or the Trump administration claimed, and that battle will go on now in the courts. Elon Musk and some Republicans are calling for that judge, who was appointed during the Obama era, to be impeached. Also along the way, he announced the secret JFK files on the assassination of the president in 1963 will be released in full later this morning. There are also files on Robert F. Kennedy and Martin Luther King, but I don't think they're being released today. Trump also announced a phone call with Putin, which will happen today, that will formally return the Russian dictator to the political stage, global stage, that he's been frozen out of since invading Ukraine. And also on Air Force One, Trump said they would discuss dividing up assets, whatever that means, in Ukraine. And he was also hit in the face with a fluffy microphone. at one stage, was a video to behold because he gets brushed against the chin and there's a glare he gives to the young woman who we believe is from National Public Radio, NPR over there, according to MAGA activists who are tracking her down and claiming that she's a Trump hater and did it on purpose, which of course she didn't do. And there are several polls again showing his approval ratings are really sliding on particularly his handling of the economy because eggs are now between $7 and $10 a dozen. There's rationing, reports of rationing of eggs in several states as well. You can buy eggs, buy single eggs in shops. And there are other polls showing half of all Americans are now opposed to Elon Musk's cuts to the civil service. His DOGE employees broke into the US Peace Institute, where those people working in that say this is not a federal agency, it is an independent agency, and there's a row about that. And meanwhile, Donald Trump also posted that he won a golf club championship at Trump International Golf Club in Palm Beach. And this happened while storms were killing dozens of people in the US Midwest and South over the weekend, tornadoes destroying homes and blackouts in various places. He did post about the storms later on Sunday, to be fair, but it was after he announced his round of golf, winning round of golf. And that's what's been going on.
Yeah, I guess we're all caught up now. How I wish we weren't. That's where we have to leave the monologue from this morning's Oliver Callan before we get to the visit of the man who claims to speak for Ireland. We are, according to Claire Byrne this morning, in exam season, and oral exams are coming around fast. In fact, they're starting next month. Claire was joined from Limerick by Dan Sheedy, former secondary school teacher and principal of the Tuition Centre.
One area where Leaving Cert students have it a bit more tricky now, definitely, is the orals. You know, the orals used to be on, you'd have Irish, let's say, the week before Easter. Then you'd have your Easter holidays for 2 weeks. Then you'd have your foreign languages after Easter, which was just perfect. You know, you could study for your Irish, do it before Easter, then spend Easter studying for your languages. But since COVID, the oral exams are all run in the first week of the Easter holidays, so the 12th to the 17th of April this year.
That's very tricky, isn't it, Dan? Because you could have, say, your Irish on the Monday and your Spanish on Tuesday.
Yeah, it is tricky. And you know, Claire, schools are very good though. Schools will know this and they'll try and schedule the Irish maybe for the Monday and then for the last day, or the Saturday, I should say, and then the last day, the Wednesday, the Thursday, is the languages. But there's no doubt that does make it a little bit more tricky for the current cohort of Leaving Cert students. And the orals are something they don't need any additional stress about. It's something students do get very nervous about, to be fair.
Mm-hmm. So the examiner then for the orals, they're teachers generally from other schools. Is that how it works still?
They are, yeah. Like, a large part of the nerves the students have is they think the examiner is someone coming down from the Department of Education, you know, and they're coming down as a stern examiner to dock marks. The examiners are just teachers from maybe one county over, you know, earning a few extra bob maybe during the Easter holidays. They have maybe 15 orals to get through in a day. So they're a friendly face. The best thing for students to realise is they're the same as their teachers. Mm-hmm. They're just from a different classroom. And it can be, Claire, intimidating, because when they go into the oral exam, they see this recording device. Now, none of us likes being recorded or the sound of our own voice. And I suppose any Leaving Cert who are listening to this, it's important to know that nobody ever listens to that. And though you are recorded, no one ever plays that back and judges you on that. That recording device is basically just there in case the examiner loses their notes, which never happens.
Oh, right. So they'll have made their decision based on the notes that they're taking while they're in the conversation with you.
Exactly. There's no review. The recording device, you can basically ignore it. It's very rarely, if ever, been used at all. And I suppose the second thing that could throw a Leaving Cert student, though it's rare, is every now and then there will be a supervising examiner in there. So there's two people. And students will say, oh God, I had two people in there.
Two of them looking at me and listening to me.
Yeah, and they think the second person is judging them, but they aren't. They're there actually to judge the examiner. So it's in your favour if the supervising examiner is in there. The examiner's got to do their job really well for you.
Right. Well, listen, let's split them into two. So we'll look at the Irish first. How much is the Irish oral worth?
So the Irish oral, it's a whopper. It's 40% of the grade, you know, 240 out of 600 marks. So you can look at that two ways. You can say, oh my God, 40% of my grade is down to 15 minutes. Or you could take the positive view and say, I have a chance here to lock in a great grade. And it sounds like 15 minutes, but believe it or not, Claire, the conversation part of the Irish oral, where you're having that dreaded chat, that's only about 8 minutes. Mm-hmm. I mean, the Irish oral is structured wonderfully to help students. You know, they're going to walk into the exam, they know the first five questions. They have to be the same. It's called the welcome or the falcha. They have to be the same for every student. What's your name? What's your age? What's your date of birth? Where are you from? And what's your exam number? And
so they're set questions. So you can have those ready.
Yeah, and then immediately after that, so let's say that takes 1 to 2 minutes, you know. Immediately after that then is the poetry section worth 35 marks. And what happens here, and this is, I think this is fabulous for students, there's 5 poems set and the examiner will say, well, I want you to read X. They'll pick one of the 5. But the beauty of this is you bring in your own notes and you can have the phonics inserted, the correct pronunciation. So it's not like the examiner hands you something to read. It can be your own notes of that poem with all your little helpful tips written beside it in terms of pronunciation. And as my daughter said to me, she's doing the orals this year, she said reading the poet, or the poem I should say, for is worth 35 marks. And that's the same as the poetry question in paper 2, which mm-hmm. you have to study so hard for. So, you know, you're probably 6 minutes in then, you've had your welcome questions, you've your poetry done, and then you come to what they all fear. You know, the chat.
You see, the fear around this is, oh, they can ask me anything. And they can really, but you can be clever about it and you can steer the conversation maybe where you would like to go.
Exactly. And, you know, you got to realise that, you know, we're dealing with teenagers here. And in my experience, they're particularly good at diverting conversations to where they want to go or away from where they don't want to go. Now, it's normally, you know, what time did you get in last night? But for the oral, they can divert the question. So, for example, we all know the first few questions they're going to be asking you is about your family. So let's say, you know, Claire Byrne is in her oral now and she has prepared lots on sport. So she wants to be asked about sport. So all she's got to do is answering the question about your family. I've got 2 sisters. I've got a brother. I'm really close to my brother because we play the same sport.
Mm.
Now, every examiner wants to follow your lead. So the next question is guaranteed to be about sport. So some people call these tags. Some people call them breadcrumbs for the examiner. But it's what the examiner wants. He wants the student to lead the conversation. He's doing 15 of these every day, or she's doing 15 of these every day. Show me what you want to talk about. And you can drop these breadcrumbs anywhere. And, you know, it applies the opposite. If they ask you about sport, it's okay to say, no, I've no interest in sport. If they ask you about your summer holidays, you can say, well, actually, I didn't go on summer holidays last year because I was playing so much sport.
Now, you're filling me full of confidence about the examiner, but what if the examiner doesn't pick up the breadcrumbs that I've left for them, or is a bit of a stickler and they want to talk about music and I know nothing about music? How do I get out of that one?
It's very, very important for students in the oral exam to say, I don't know much about that, or I don't have a lot of interest in that. And the examiners are very happy to hear that. They don't want you trying to stumble over topics that you're not comfortable with. And, you know, they're teachers. They'll have been prepping their own students for the last month or two. They'll spot the signs that you're uncomfortable. And again, I suppose it comes back to the first point. You know, a lot of students would say, well, will I get docked marks for this? You know, nothing in the leave insert is negatively marked. You're never docked marks for anything. It's an accumulation of marks. So if the examiner's asking you a little stickler of a question, I would say 2 things to that. Number one, get away from it and be comfortable getting away from it. You know, I've no interest in that. And he or she will move on. But the second thing would be, very often those little tricky questions will come at the end of the exam. And it's a sign that you've done so well, that the examiner thinks you're so fluent, you're speaking so well, he'll throw one difficult question at you. You've probably already got the full marks.
That's a relief. Or is it? That probably is doing a lot of heavy lifting there. Dan Sheedy there, principal of the tuition centre, talking to Claire Byrne this morning about the Leaving Cert oral exams, which are bearing down on sixth year students like an avalanche of unusually spelled words. Nikita spoke to Philip Boucher-Hayes on this afternoon's Liveline and told him about the pain she's been in for a long time.
It started 3.5 years ago and I've gotten progressively worse. And no doctor seemed to want to listen or want to help. Or I'm not urgent enough, apparently, according to them.
What kind of pain are we talking about? Where is it on a 1 to 10?
Right now I'd say it's at about an 8 or a 9.
How are you even talking to me?
I have no idea.
It must be very hard to concentrate through that pain. And is it all over, Nikita?
Mainly my stomach and my back.
Okay. And you think, though you don't have a diagnosis, you think it's endometriosis?
Yeah, my doctors have said they think it's that, but I'm too young, is what they say.
Too young for endometriosis officially. So how long would you have to wait to get a diagnosis and see if that's what it is indeed?
We don't really know. We keep ringing doctors and we just get voice machines and stuff like that.
Okay, but you're on a waiting list for an MRI, is it, or have you already had an MRI?
We went private and got an MRI done.
And was that in any way inconclusive?
It was okay. They said there was nothing sticking out.
Nothing particularly obvious. Okay.
Yeah.
And why is it that you think that it's endometriosis?
I've been kind of listening to other people's stories, and it just everything kind of just matches up with that.
Like
and
what?
My doctor, bleeding kind of on and off, and pain, pelvic pain, and bowel problems, bladder problems.
Okay, and does the kind of pain that you're feeling change throughout the course of the month, throughout your cycle?
Yeah, we noticed that my pain would get really, really bad a week before I would get my cycle.
Okay, so that would certainly point in the direction of something going on in your womb or outside your womb, as the case may be.
Yeah.
So what are the options for treatment here, Nikita?
One of my doctors called me a few weeks ago, and she said that she's concerned that if it is endometriosis, it's spread to the bowel and the bladder. So she said that I probably will have to get surgery to see if it is endometriosis, but I'm too young.
You're too young for the surgery, okay. I know that we've had a lot of calls on Liveline in the past about people who have gone to Romania and successfully sought treatment for endometriosis. Is that an option for you, or are they likely to say, no, I'm sorry, Nikita, you're too young as well?
I'm not too sure. I think my mum would look into anything and everything at this point. It's just getting worse and worse.
What do you do with your days?
I literally just sit in the bed. I can't even lie down because of the pain.
So you're kind of curled up in a bit of a fetal position?
I can't even lie down like that. Like, I'm crisscross sitting up.
And do you sleep like that?
I barely sleep, but if I do, I sleep sitting up.
Okay, so you're awake through the night when the rest of us all are asleep. It must be very lonely.
Yeah, it is.
How long has it been since you've actually been in school?
3 months now.
And before that, in the course of the 3.5 years that this had been going on, was school interrupted?
Yeah, I only kind of, last year they gave me an injection and that worked for a few months. So I was able to go to school during those few months. But before that, a week before my cycle, I'd be out of school.
Okay, so that's really not a lasting solution either at all, is it? Talk to me though about your friends. I mean, obviously schooling is interrupted, but are you able to maintain friendships?
Like my close friends, they still check in, but it's kind of hard because they're still trying to live their lives. So I kind of feel bad asking them to come and sit in a room with me when they should be out going shopping, doing all that stuff.
Yeah, I mean, they do have their own lives. It must be hard to keep on pulling them back into your sphere or your world. And are there many who do come and see you still?
Yeah, one of my closest friends, she'll come up and stuff like that.
Okay.
When she can, she's busy, so.
But there's those long, dark, lonely nights when nobody's going to be able to come to you. Can you read, or is the pain too distracting to do that?
I tried to sit my mock exams in January, but I couldn't do that because of the pain. Like, I couldn't concentrate.
Okay. It just keeps on penetrating your thoughts all the time and distracting you.
Yeah.
And can you even take a painkiller for a short period of time to numb it a bit?
We've tried, my dresser table is full of medicine and we've tried it all, but the only thing that seems to help is when I go into hospital and they give me, a stronger painkiller.
Right.
That they can only give in a hospital.
That's the unfortunate Nikita talking to Philip Boucher Hayes on this afternoon's Liveline about the pain she's been feeling for the last 3 years. When Paddy Armstrong was 24, he was falsely convicted of taking part in an IRA bomb attack in Guildford in England and sentenced to life in prison. That was 50 years ago this year. Armstrong and his three friends, who all became known as the Guildford Four, were released in 1989 after serving almost 15 years in prison. The journalist and documentary maker Mary Elaine Tynan has recorded Armstrong's story, and now, along with actor Don Witcherly, they've turned it into a play. Mary Elaine is on directing duty and Don is starring in it. The play will tour Ireland later this year. Mary Elaine and Don joined Oliver Callan in studio this morning.
Paddy Armstrong, did you know much about him before you approached his play, Don?
No, other than the movie. He lived local to me. I'd seen him in and out of the bookies, which he's known to frequent. But I didn't know him. And when Mary Elaine started pursuing me, she can be very tenacious when she gets going. You know, she had written the book and said, you know, she spoke to Andy and Laura and the Viking, and they said, you should talk to Don if you want one man of this. And then she they gave her my number and she said someone is looking. Yeah, anyway, she wore me down, and when she said would you like to meet Paddy Armstrong, I went, God, yeah, I would, because I remember, I think I was in the Cat and Cage across from St. Pat's in Drumcondra on the 19th of October 1989. There was a graduation ceremony and we went in and they came out to the full that was going on. I still remember watching it over a pint starting my career, do you know what I mean? And going, wow, that's incredible.
So euphoric moment of news history, isn't it?
Yeah, so then to actually meet him was amazing, and sit down and obviously sat down with him a lot of times over the last while, listening to him, and not only for the voice but the stories and do you know, all that kind of stuff.
Yeah. And he lives in Dublin.
Yeah, he does.
And his family. And
he's got two amazing kids, and he's married to Caroline, who you worked with.
She taught me.
This is your connection, because it's quite a long way you get into the story, isn't it? So Caroline taught you.
She taught me in first year in school in Holy Faith in Clonfert.
Music. Oh, teach music.
And then she scared the living daylights out of me. and she was in her early years of teaching, and then later I became a teacher and she was my colleague. Mm-hmm. And so and then we worked together, and then Jerry Condon passed away, and I was subbing.
That's only in recent years, isn't it?
That was 10 years ago, yeah. So I interviewed Paddy at the time for a newspaper. And then
he had never spoken?
No, he hadn't spoken in many years. And he didn't really want to talk to anybody. You know, they had been really abused by the press. There was a huge... The campaign by the press when they were originally convicted, etc., was terrible. And he was very suspicious. But Caroline said to me, look, he'd talk to you, because she knew me. And so I interviewed him. And then I made the documentary with the RTÉ documentary on one... about him, and then he asked me to write his memoir, and I was like, not a chance am I writing your memoir.
That documentary, you bring him back to England, to the places that he would have been familiar to him, obviously, when he was living free and before he was wrongfully convicted.
That was incredible. That,
how was he on that trip?
Oh wow, it was very emotional, because we went back to the places he squatted. We went back to Guildford. There was a really incredible moment in Guildford when we were standing outside one of the pubs, and it's now a Costa Coffee, and we meet this lad, and he's looking at us with, you know, all the mics and everything. And he says, what are you doing? And we explained it to him, and he said, oh my God, that Costa Coffee is where the pub used to be. And then he started apologising to Paddy, and he got very emotional and saying how sorry he was. And it was really interesting, because we tried to interview other people on the streets of Guildford, but they wouldn't speak to us. We got quite a bit of resistance from older people. Yeah, because not everyone necessarily knew. A lot of people thought that they'd been, you know, released on a technicality. So anyway, so we made the documentary and it went really well. He asked me to write his memoir. And then based on that, I decided I wanted to write this play, because I felt like there's different ways of telling stories. You know, like when you think about, say, for example, that the ITV, the scandal, the ITV drama about the post office scandal.
Yeah.
And I just felt like there are really beautiful dramas, and they show a different way to tell a story, you know, bring it to a different audience in a different way. And I went to a friend of mine, Niamh Gleeson, who is she writes for Fair City. She's a brilliant writer. And she helped me write the initial draft of the script. Wow. And I did know, I knew this quirky fella who I thought might be able to pull it off.
Was that me?
I don't know.
Did you say people in Guildford still don't really believe that these convictions should have been?
Listen, Oliver, I was. We did the pub in the Viking, and a fella downstairs said, "There's no smoke without fire. How do you? How my can God. You do that?" And I said, look, you cannot convince some people once it's there, and once he's done 15 years, people are going to form an opinion. We're in a world of opinions, and people have them.
It shows that people have doubted the truth for a long time.
Yes, and will continue to do so. You'll always get people. And I was looking at him going, knowing the research we've done, the research Mary Lane had done, having spoken about it, he couldn't even drive, and they accused him of driving the car to Guildford, going into the pub, placing the bomb. He said, I don't know where Guildford is. I don't drive. You know,
he looked nothing like the witness descriptions.
And Paddy now was living the high life in London, smoking a bit, drinking too much, and partying. Basically, he moved out of his rental accommodation because
he found
the rental situation a bit too much. So he said the squat suited his lifestyle better, and so he was just kind of living the high life. And suddenly one morning, the door broke down, and
That was his life.
That was it. That was
taken
it.
From and, under him. Is he angry now?
You don't get that. Like, I think the thing about Paddy, and I think we try to get across in the play, he is so funny, and he has that, you mentioned at the start, the Belfast humour, the black humour. His default setting is a joke, a gag. Maybe it's because when I ask him some stuff that might be deep or heavy, he kind of goes, and then he goes, and then he'll deflect with a joke, and he's always got a gag. He's
really?
Always ready with it, you know. And so I think we've captured a lot of that in the play, that he is just this funny man, and he is. And he's always messing. Are you any good? Do you know what I mean? You're playing me, is it? Are you good? I said, you know, I don't know. I was terrified when we did that. We did a show, the first one for himself and Caroline, and they sat in the little theatre, the Viking, upstairs in the sheds. And
just the two of them.
And I don't think I've ever been more terrified, because I haven't played that many people that are in the audience that I'm playing. Do you know what I mean? And for him to be watching, and it was his family. I was talking about his sisters, his mother, his father, and you know, he's there, and you hear little chuckles in the dark, and it's going, okay, he's going with it, Do you know what I mean? At least he hasn't got up and walked out. Do you know what I mean? This is not my life. Anyway, cut a long story short, he did.
You got a standing ovation from him, Dan.
Yes, I got a standing ovation in the dark from Paddy. So, yeah, he loved it.
Best reception
yesterday.
You've ever had.
Yeah, we went to see him for Paddy's Day yesterday.
I mean, opening night was a doddle after that, really, wasn't it?
It was.
So, yeah. Yeah, great.
What was his hottest tip for you playing him?
What was his hottest tip? He said
you better be good looking.
Yeah. Well, he said he's better looking, I think. He said, I'm better looking, but, you know, it's acceptable. I'm just about acceptable.
Did he know you were from West Cork before you began? Or did you have to hide that fact?
Yeah, I think I told him where I was from. I was just constantly doing him. Over the while when we were working on it, Caroline very kindly said, just knock in, he'll be watching telly in the window. I'd knock and go in with a flat white or a few custard creams, which he's partial to.
Oh, right.
And he'd just sit down.
Became pals then.
Well,
he'd just start
talking and ask him a few questions. He had the Pink Floyd album on the wall. He was mad into his music and assigned by everybody. And he's just very, very into the music. He'd be talking about Van the Man, or do you know what I mean? He's just, and I think the music got him through that, and humour got him through that 15 years.
Don Witcherly and Mary Lane Tynan talking to Oliver Callan this morning about their play on the life of the Guildford Four's Paddy Armstrong. The play is called Paddy, The Life and Times of Paddy Armstrong, and you can find performance dates and tickets on the website lifeandtimesofpaddy.com. Back on the Today programme, and you may not have heard of Gus Crawford Collins and Kim Hayden of Dream A Lot, but you've almost certainly heard their music, because it's featured on Netflix, on Love Island, on Apple TV Plus, on PlayStation, and many other places. Gus and Kim joined Claire Byrne this morning.
Maybe, Kim, if you start us off. Like, you create music that we'll hear on TV, in gaming trailers and film trailers. Is that right?
Yeah, that's it. So we make music to match the visuals and set the atmosphere in scenes or trailers or the reality TV shows like Love Island as well. So it's a nice mix.
Yeah. And how did that start then, Gus?
We've been musicians for years, and then it was really COVID that gave us the chance to actually work with each other. We've been saying it for ages that we wanted to get into film and trailers but just the whole movie realm. So it was having that downtime literally just allowed us to get stuck in.
But where do
creating.
You start? Hello, movie mogul. Yeah. We're here in Ireland. How did you make the break?
It was literally just a case of being tenacious and cold calling people and hitting them up via various means. And you know, you could send out, you know, 300 emails and you might get one or two responses, and then that would lead to the next thing. And it was just a case of building up from ground zero. Literally, we didn't know anybody at all in this specific realm when we started, so it's just a case of building the trust with people. And then it was really essentially the Trailer House Create who we worked with on with all the Netflix productions. The team there gave us our kind of first first really big break, and that led into the...
They replied to the email.
Yeah, they replied to the email.
They were one of the ones that responded. So thank you, Create.
Yes.
Yeah. I mean, COVID was a thing as well where you didn't need to do the face-to-face. So people maybe were more responsive to an approach like that at that time, weren't
Definitely.
They?
I think that was our saving grace, really, because before that, you would have had to go out to LA and done the face-to-face meetings, and COVID really opened up the doors for us to just hop on a Zoom call and build it that way. So it was kind of perfect timing, really.
So Gus mentioned you were both musicians and creatives in your own right. What were you doing prior to this?
So I was more on the live scene, doing like a lot of weddings, singer-songwriting, and that was my kind of thing for years and years. I did The Voice many moons ago as well, back in 2012. So I've been more on stage. So the last few years has been the studio, which is amazing, but we are going back on stage now in July, which is very exciting.
You've a gig in Whelan's coming up.
That's
is that right,
together.
27th of July, our first Dream A Lot debut.
So Gus, what were you doing then prior to this career?
So I was on the live side as well, but I also ran a studio, and out of that studio I sort of learned how to grow in the world of sync from doing music for advertising and car launches and things like that. So I was very, very much in that sector, and it was like I learned everything I kind of know today in terms of how to deal with people and how to kind of work everything on the back end and cut to picture. But then, so we translated that into the film realm. And
so that's how this works then.
Mm.
You'll be sent some of the pictures that you have to write to.
Yeah,
well, it's funny, actually.
It changes sometimes,
In the trailer world, it's actually the other way. They ask us to create the track first, and then they'll cut the trailer to the track, which is cool. But sometimes they may send us rushes. So with the Harlan Coben stuff, obviously, it's quite specific, the storyline. So we'll often get some rushes through or a V1 cut, and then we can start piecing together
the track.
Because
you'd need to get a feel for what you're writing for, right?
Totally.
Because otherwise it could be like a really happy song going into this thriller thing. So you need to know what the tone is and the atmosphere. And it's kind of cool, though, not like seeing the visuals as well, because then when you see them actually marry together, it's like, wow, that, you know, the beauty of the creativity with the visuals and the music is amazing seeing it, yeah.
And these companies you're working with, are they all like fast, we need it now?
Oh yeah,
absolutely.
Yesterday.
They want it tomorrow
yesterday.
Morning, right?
So how much time would you be given generally to come up with a piece of music?
Like sometimes we'd have to turn a track around it within 24 hours.
What?
Yeah.
It's pretty scary.
Your studio in Wicklow, and you're sitting there and you get a commission in and you have to do it. You're working overnight, is it?
Literally, yeah. It could be, you know, sometimes you might finish at 4 or 5 in the morning, depending on. Yeah. Sometimes it's good when we're working with LA, because you can actually, you know, work late.
Still
and
communicate
then,
with them then throughout
not,
the night.
Yeah. Yeah, and then they're not up until our 5 o'clock, so it actually works well.
You know, creativity doesn't always work like that, though, does it?
No.
You know, you say, I have to do this thing, and it just doesn't happen.
Oh, we've had many of those days where you're like sitting there going, what are we going to do? This
I think
just
every artist
isn't
has,
happening. Yeah, and then, but like you can get lucky when it's like, oh, wow, it's working. But the pressure, I think, does help, but it can be a challenge as well.
Well, I think that's the magic and the beauty of music, is you never know what's going to come out when you're playing. And, you know, that's the creative process, isn't it? You know, you have to, you know, channel those energies to find what it is that you want to translate.
Well, will we name drop now some of the things that you've worked on? So,
Go for it.
Hello Tomorrow, that was, you worked on the trailer for that. That was sort of the big break, am
that
I right?
That was a big break, yeah.
And what followed on from there then?
Then it was Netflix Obsession.
Obsession, yeah. That was a big one to get with Netflix, yeah.
Mm-hmm. What did you do on that show?
We did a cover of Kylie Minogue, Can't Get You Out of My Head. And actually, Charlie Murphy is one of the main actresses in that show. So it was nice having an Irish in there as well. Yeah. So that was that one.
And then then that year was our kind of big break with Love
Harlan
Island.
Coben
so
as well.
Yeah, and Harlan Coben as well. At the end of the year. So yeah, it was Love Island in the summer. We got, I think it was 7 or 8 tracks in that series. And then Harlan Coben, Fool Me Once at the end of the year, which was amazing. So
and that was huge, wasn't it?
Massive.
I mean, that was number one everywhere when it came out, wasn't it?
Yeah. We did the Christina Aguilera cover of Fighter for that one. And then the latest one was Missing, All About the Girl. So,
Well, I think we have a clip from the Christina Aguilera cover, which we can listen to now. This features in the trailer for Fool Me Once. Let's have a listen to this. You were given permission, of course, to cover some of these songs by the biggest artists in the world, including Christina Aguilera.
I am a star. I ain't gonna stop. There is no
so familiar now from watching Fool Me Once, now that I hear it again. Will you talk me through the process then? How do you arrive at, you know, taking Christina Aguilera's hit and putting it in there?
In terms of what, the musicality or the... Or
the idea, the concept, okay. The whole thing.
Okay, well, normally it's the trailer house that would reach out to us and say, oh, look, this, you know, they brief us on the programme, and then they'd say, look, we're toying with a couple of track ideas, and we'd quite often sort of talk through and say, we come to an agreement that we'd say, oh, let's try Christina Aguilera's Fighter. Mm-hmm. That would, for that one, I think there was a couple of choices and we all felt that was the best one to go with.
Yeah.
So we literally just jumped in.
A very daunting one to take
on,
though.
Big time, yeah.
She's one of my idols as well. So I was like, oh my God, this is so scary.
How do I touch this one?
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
But it was a fun process. We just sit down at the piano, we jam it out and start piecing it together, and then arrive at a fairly decent V1 to send over to the trailer house, and they'll start cutting, and they might come back with some extra bits. Amazing in that case, I think it was only one amendment, was just to go even bigger at the end of it. So
because there's a sense of eeriness and mystery injected into that song there. That's what I heard anyway.
Cool.
Am I right? Is that what I'm supposed to hear?
Spot on. Yeah, absolutely.
Phew. Claire passes the atmospheric music test this morning in conversation with Gus Crawford Collins and Kim Hayden of Dreamalot. And the Dreamalot duo will be playing a gig in Whelan's in Dublin on the 27th of July. Sauna culture, a new one on me, I confess, is growing rapidly in Ireland. That's according to Brendan Courtney, sitting in for Ray Darcy this afternoon. Tegan Olish describes itself as an Irish sweat house and hosts a range of events in its saunas, including singles nights, raves, and a pop-up Gaeltacht. I know that sounds, well, unlikely for a sauna, but let's let co-founder Carl Priestley tell us about it.
Why do you think sauna culture has become so popular in Ireland? Do we have a sort of a DNA connection to it somehow?
Yeah, good question. Absolutely is the answer. We myself and my brother, Peter, set it up, and we are basically calling it a sauna revival. Because in Ireland, there is a tradition of sweat houses, and hence our name, Tig and Ollis. Tig meaning a house, and Ollis meaning to perspire, to sweat. So they date back hundreds of years in Ireland.
And were they called Tig and Ollis? They were called sweat houses?
Yeah, and they were traditionally built in the form of a beehive hut.
I think I've seen them, pictures of them, yeah.
Yeah, there's some structures still in Leitrim. That you can actually go and visit. I visited one and they're amazing. And
so hold on a second. So historically, and how long ago were we talking these would have been used?
Like towards the end of the 19th century.
Wow.
We're kind of finishing up, but
So our great-great-grandfathers or great-great-great-grandfathers would have been aware of these sweat houses. And what were they used for?
So they were known for treatments for like colds and for rheumatoid arthritis. And people used to have a cold plunge beside them.
No way!
So like in the form of a stream or a cold dip.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, so what we are saying at the moment, that this isn't a new craze, that it's actually a revival, and that we want to bring this back to Ireland.
Because actually every time I'm in a sauna, and which is a lot actually, weirdly, is you have these kind of conversations with people, especially my age, going, isn't this amazing that these people are just like, I kind of maybe without sounding condescending, I can understand why younger people are attracted to it because it's kind of new and fresh. Mm-hmm. But this is interesting because we have a connection to it. It's really interesting. So were they right? Was it curing anything?
Yeah, like personally speaking, just from using saunas regularly, a couple of benefits, like sleep. My sleep is terrible. And after a year of saunas, my sleep has improved greatly. Athletic recovery, you know, if you're into your hiking or biking, it's amazing for the next day. You know, you're not as stiff.
Yeah.
Your joints are kind of loose. And our one, where we're located at the Gap, is in nature. So you have to hike up to us, a short hike up the mountain, and you have views looking over the Wicklow Mountains. And
oh, I think I've seen you. Mm. I did the night hike a year ago. Would have walked past you?
Yeah. We're based on the Dublin Mountain Way as
beautiful.
Well.
Yeah, so it's got incredible views and everything. So Is there scientific proof of the benefits? Now, loads of people sitting beside me will give me details of the benefits. What I heard, a sauna and a cold dip is, and you jump in now anytime, right? So I heard the sauna, your blood goes to your skin to cool you. And then the cold dip, your blood rushes to your organs to protect you. So you do between the cold and the hot. And that naturally massages your lymph system and, you know, massages your organs gently. Is that fact? Is that rubbish?
No, absolutely not.
Is like, it not?
This contrast therapy, so the hot and cold, has numerous benefits, and like the release of endorphins, and you're getting rid of the bad toxins. And I just personally, I'm such a believer in it now. And I was skeptical at the start, and you know, a lot of my friends are just, as you said, every week having three or four sessions and just switching off the phone. That's the big thing.
Yeah. And being present.
Yeah.
And my goodness, when you get into cold water, are you present?
Yeah.
And is there any science behind the benefits yet? Has anybody done any proper tests on this?
Yeah.
There is.
There has. Research has been carried out, and the newest form of research is based on mental health.
Okay.
The improvement that can have on your, you know, emotional and well-being.
Yeah.
And I have seen that firsthand as well.
So how many sessions a week to feel the benefits? One is good, right? But how many would be optimal?
Yeah, like everybody's body is different. And, you know, from what I've read, 3 sessions a week, they reckon around 45 minutes. So 3 hot sessions, like 10 to 15 minutes. And then your cold plunge to, you know, combine the two. Is good.
Okay. Now, you were a primary school teacher before you set up the sauna.
Yeah.
And are you full-time sauna now?
Yeah, full-time.
And is saunaing a verb?
Jeez, I don't know. Oscar Elga, maybe, but...
yeah. Tell me now, you're doing some really interesting stuff. Singles events. That's brilliant. A singles event in a sauna. What happens?
Yeah, it's a new one.
Just to tell you a story that you just reminded me, my very, very, very first sauna was about 5 or 6, maybe 7 years ago, Busca Baja in Glenmalure. Yeah. And I met a couple on the date, and he said, "This is Siobhan from Tinder."
No
in
way.
The sauna. I was like, whose idea was this? Genius. Yeah. So what happens on the singles events?
So we ran a singles event recently enough, and the demand was ridiculous.
Really?
More so female than male.
Okay.
There was a waiting list for the females.
Yeah.
And basically we had a host, Alana Rush is her name, and she hosted the night.
Right.
And we had 11 single males, 11 single females, and they filled out an application form before. So we got some, you know, pre-data on them.
Yeah.
And based on that, she introduced everybody, and they had the choice of the 2 saunas.
Yeah.
So they played games, they had, you know, topics of conversation to talk about.
Yeah.
And then the end of the night, optional, we gathered and had a drink.
Yeah, amazing. Yeah. And so were people nervous? Like you're in your swimwear.
Yeah, the first 5 or 10 minutes, I'll be honest, you know, it was cagey. But honestly, after a few minutes, it was a success, and we're going to run many more of them.
Really?
Yeah.
So you've only done one, but you're definitely going to do more.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And did any couples get together?
Yeah, I think there was one match.
Out of 11?
Yeah, so far.
That's a pretty high hit rate.
Yeah. And then we also ran last Friday a ladies' night. So full moon ladies' night. And that was amazing. And 22 ladies that didn't know each other gathered and had the best night of their lives.
So I actually was saying I went to see the moon up in Wicklow Town because I thought it was fake, because that was part of a movie set. It was the crest, it was just unbelievable. The blood crest moon, it was just unbelievable. And I met somebody going to a full moon worship thing, one of my neighbours.
Yeah.
And so there's something magic happens in a sauna. It's that it's almost the most equal space you can be in. So it really doesn't matter who you're talking to. And quickly tell me about the sauna raves.
Yeah, so that's also another first for Ireland. So we've teamed up with a company called Rave to Remember.
Okay.
And a lady called Shireen Langan, you might know of her, set it up with her brother and a friend, Molly. And basically they're hosting sober raves in coffee shops and different venues.
Cool.
And on the 18th of May, we have our first sauna rave.
Okay. Where can people find out about it?
Yeah, online through Tig and Ollis, our social media. And basically you sign up and there will be a DJ set, there'll be a coffee truck, and we've 2 saunas on site.
Amazing.
And yeah, can't wait.
That's probably the oddest thing I've heard today. And I live in 2025. I'm obviously not that attuned to sauna culture in Ireland. Shame on me. That was Irish Sweathouse Tegan Eilish co-founder Carl Priestley talking to Brendan Courtney on this afternoon's Ray Darcy Show. Finally, on this edition of Playback Daily, won't someone please think of the pets? Claire Byrne confessed to vet Nia Fagan that when it comes to her pet's dental health, she's fond of throwing them a dental chew every now and again. That's not as awful as Claire thinks, says Nia, but it's not enough either.
The dental chews, not a fan, or are they okay?
No, they do work, they do. They help, but they're not the kind of mainstay to maintaining our dogs' and cats' teeth. The most important and most effective way to maintain dental care is by brushing. Mm-hmm. And it's what everybody, you know, they hate to hear it, but it is the most important thing. So it's starting early if you can with kittens and puppies. And a lot of vets will now recommend that when a kitten or a puppy comes in for a first vaccine. Start early, go slow, get a nice tasty toothpaste. So a dog or cat toothpaste, it can't be human toothpaste. A children's toothbrush is fine, or a pet's toothbrush.
So they're allergic to the fluoride, are they, in our toothpaste?
It's toxic, yeah, exactly. So, and it doesn't taste minty. They're not going to want that. It's the dog and cat toothpaste. It's either liver flavoured or chicken flavoured. Pretend it's a treat, do you know, kind of make it an enjoyable experience as much as possible for the pet, and you'll have success that way.
So how do you start? Because I wouldn't know how to begin with this.
Yeah. So kind of, as I said, they're using it as a treat. So that's the very first step. So just let them lick the toothpaste off your finger, do you know, get them to sit and do it that way. Or the same with cats, just getting them to taste it. Second step would be then getting them to lick it off the toothbrush, but not going at them with the toothbrush. Mm-hmm. Third step then, putting the toothbrush in and around their mouth. And then the fourth step is brushing. And those steps should be kind of separated out, maybe do it for a week or even 2 weeks. It can even be a bit longer. It could take 6 months to build this up. It's kind of the same as teaching your dog to walk on a lead or sit or whatever it might be. It's
time and patience.
Time and patience. It's routine. It's the most important thing.
And how often do you have to do it then?
Yeah. So every day would be ideal, but it's not practical, especially with kids in the house and busy lives. So if you could do it 2 to 3 times a week, plaque sits on the teeth and that turns to calculus after about 3 to 4 days. So, and when that happens, it's like cement on the teeth. No brushing in the world is going to take that off. And that's where you'll need your dental procedures, such as a scale and polish or even teeth extracted. So it's really important to do it at minimum 2 to 3 times a week.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. How do you know then if your dog or your cat has a little problem in their mouth?
Yeah. So usually the first symptom or, you know, what clients would come in with is my dog's breath is smelly and chronically smelly. It's not just a couple of days. It's smelly all the time. So the breath, the other symptoms can be, so if you just lift the lip of your dog or cat, not kind of opening the mouth that way, lift the lip, very simple, you'll see a brown kind of coating on the teeth. Teeth shouldn't be that colour. So that's the plaque that we're talking about. And that is essentially bacteria, which is then sitting on the gums. The gums then have access to the bloodstream, and that bacteria then is going into the bloodstream all the time. It'll also cause irritation to that gum. So the gum will be red. It won't be a nice pink colour. So any type of redness, there's different severities of it, and you will get really, really red, sore gums.
So when you lift the dog's lip or the cat's lip, what you want to see is a pale pink gum.
Pale pink gum and a nice white tooth. Mm. Yeah.
And if you don't see that, then you could be heading for problems.
Yeah. Yeah.
And you mentioned then about this bacteria getting into the bloodstream. Mm-hmm. So ultimately, where could we be headed with this?
Yeah. So that passes around the circulatory system, which is your heart, liver and kidney. And that sounds very severe, but day in, day out, years as they go by, it causes inflammation in those organs and then infection. So we see a lot of kidney disease linked with bad dental disease in dogs particularly. So that's really, really important to make sure that we're maintaining our pet's teeth for that reason.
And are there any particular breeds then that would be more vulnerable to this?
Definitely. So smaller breeds with dogs, most commonly, so your Yorkshire Terriers and your Chihuahuas, some sighthounds, so greyhounds, dogs like that, will have really severe dental disease. And with that, you just need to be as mindful as possible. So doing the brushing, but then also using the dental chews. There's dental food that you can get as well. There's also powders and enzymatic treatments that you can put into their water, onto their food, which helps. So you might need to use multiple ways of maintaining the teeth rather than just brushing.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yeah. And how would you know if your dog has, say, an abscess or something? Yeah. What sort of behavioural changes would you see?
So sometimes we'll see that they go off the food, but not in every case. And particularly with cats as well, they don't tend to go off the food. You might see subtly that they're going to eat to one side, they might favour one side of their mouth, or drooling. Drooling is a big sign. So where your dog didn't drool before and now they are, okay, maybe there's something there. Sometimes you won't see an abscess, you won't see any pus or anything like that. An x-ray might need to be taken. And that's where you need to have your vet visit and have your vet assess.
Just like humans, really. I mean, really uncomfortable if you have a dental problem. One of the worst pains that you can have, right?
Absolutely. And if we didn't brush our teeth, you know, so it all links up.
Yeah. Listen, we've loads of questions coming in. So this is from Cliona, who has a 7-year-old dog who won't let her brush his teeth. He had his teeth cleaned under anaesthetic when he was 5, so 2 years ago, which was a condition of his health insurance. Have you any advice for ongoing care? Well, you've gone through it there, really. It's a long process, isn't it?
It is, yeah. So if she could go back to trying to introduce the toothpaste and really, really try without brushing. Some dogs, they won't. And it is, that's acceptable. But there is those other forms of treatment that I mentioned. So the dental food could be a way of trying to maintain his teeth, and the dental chews. But some dogs and cats will just need scale and polishes every year, every 2 years maybe. So unfortunately, that is the case.
And that is really expensive, because Aoife has been in touch. She has a Bichon Yorkie mix, and she was quoted, wait for this now, €800 to get the dog's teeth cleaned.
Yeah.
Is that normal?
So in that case, I would expect that maybe we're looking at some extractions as well. A teeth cleaning from in a general practice veterinary clinic, you probably wouldn't be looking at that high. Mm. But I reckon,
if you needed an anaesthetic for it.
Yeah, anaesthetic, absolutely. You maybe would be looking at in around €400. So it is still expensive. But sometimes when the dental disease progresses, you need to remove teeth. And that is, it takes a lot of time. Some of those teeth have 3-4 roots, and so they need to be removed. It takes a lot of time, so that's why it can be so expensive. Now, some veterinary clinics, and this is becoming more and more popular, will do pet health plans. And so where I work in Highfield, we have a dental plan. Mm-hmm. And with
so
that,
you can get insurance, in other words,
in a way, sort of a
pay as you go thing where you're not
exactly. Yeah, yeah. So it'll be a monthly fee, and then you'll get your anaesthetic and your scale and polish free. So it just helps spread the cost, but it is very expensive.
Like everything else these days, maybe we should all stick to the dental chews, eh? That's vet Nia Fagan talking to Claire Byrne this morning about good dental hygiene for cats and dogs. And that's all I have for you on this short week edition of Playback Daily. The programme was compiled, written and edited by me, Neil O'Shuradon. Don't forget, you can listen back to all the programmes featured on Playback Daily on the RTE radio app. And the mothership, that's Playback, is on air and in podcast land every Saturday, when Sinead Mooney has a fitter, happier, more productive look back at an entire week in radio. For me, though, until the next time, thank you for listening, and good luck.